Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, SALT iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io.
When you're trading options, Fidelity has just what you need, with straightforward but powerful tools to help you select a strategy and execute your ideas. And they offer a wide range of information and insights to help simplify your trading experience. Have a question? Ask it live during their small classes and coaching sessions. Need information? Check out their educational videos, articles, and webinars. See why it's easy to trade options your way at Fidelity. Start now at fidelity.com/options.
Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request.
All right, welcome to the On the Tape podcast. I am Dan Nathan, joined by Guy Adami. Guy,
yo!
How are you?
I'm well. I'm very well, actually.
We have a special pod for you today.
Well, hold on a second. You're saying that today's a special pod, which means other pods that we do.
I was going to say stylistically, it's special. How's that?
Okay, that's fair.
So you and I are going to do a quick intro here.
Yeah,
because we had a big week. We had a lot of great content on the Risk Reversal Media platform, aside from Market Call that you and I do every Monday through Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern on our Risk Reversal Media page. I had a great conversation with Gene Munster of Deepwater, and we talked about the TikTok ban. We talked about what went down out in SF as it relates to GTC. That would be the NVIDIA conference there. We talked about Apple and Google potentially tying up in the generative AI space. So that was a great conversation on OK Computer, dropped on Wednesday. Check that out. Yesterday, on Thursday, we had a drop. I was with the Compound Bros. That would be downtown Josh Brown and Michael Batnick, okay? And we had a great conversation about market sentiment, market at new highs, all the debate in and around inflation and what the Fed's doing and the like here. Those guys got all up in my grill, Guy Adami. But that was a great conversation. And then when you and I are done recapping the week, and we're going to be quick here, people, Danny Moses sat down with his former partners, Vincent Daniel, Porter Collins. They did a little, what are we doing? They talked about the Fed. They talked about the inflation debate. They talked about how the market keeps chugging along despite maybe some signs of weakness, growing federal debt. Well, what do we want to focus on right now to kind of put a little bow on this week that was in the market? Because there were two big events between NVIDIA and what's happened with Micron. And then obviously with what's going on with the Fed and this dovish commentary, markets are raging, S&P 5250. What are we doing?
Well, everything you just mentioned, your conversation with Gene,
yep,
your conversation with the TRB,
yep,
Michael Batnick,
yep,
and then the fact that Danny Moses is speaking to Porter and Vinny. You know what it has me?
What?
Jealous again.
Oh, there you go.
Now, that's a little Black Crows.
Yes.
But, you know, the title of this podcast, as I'm thinking about it, not only am I jealous again, it's the Fed is once again dovish again. And if you think about that, the commentary we heard on Wednesday can only be construed as that. And the fact that they seemingly are saying, you know what, we get the inflation, we're not all that concerned about it. As we see gasoline prices go higher, as we see copper prices go higher, obviously crude oil going higher, all the components that are inflationary are starting to go lower left to upper right, and we've seen a reacceleration. I think what they've effectively told you is, you know what, we sort of see that in the rearview mirror. We think it's somewhat noisy at this point, and we're good with 3 rate cuts. Now, the oddity to me is the fact that when there were 6 rate cuts predicated for this year, the market was off to the races in the fall of last year. It got cut down to 3. The market sold off for like a day. Now that they've basically told you it's going to be 3, the market's off to the races again. So from 6 to 3, you have a market that seemingly rallies on just about everything. So I find that fascinating. But I also will point out that some of these underlying things below the surface, all the things we talked about, have not gotten better. In some ways, they've gotten worse.
And what I find most interesting is that the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield is still in and around 4.3%. The last time that the 10-year was at 4.3%, the S&P was near 4,600. That's where the 200-day moving average is right now, Guy, in the S&P 500. And we have it at 5,250 as we're talking. The other thing I'll just mention here is that the VIX is below 13, so it's very near a 52-week low. The MOVE index that tracks volatility in the Treasury market is at a new 52-week low. So when you're talking about a dollar that's strengthening, you're talking about inflation that's strengthening, you're talking about crude oil that's strengthening, you're talking about industrial commodities aside like copper, like you just mentioned, strengthening, all of a sudden now you have this situation where the stock market doesn't care about yields. They don't care about rising inflation. So to me, I find that really interesting at a time where our good friend EY from SoFi, that would be Liz Young, last week on the pod, she talked about the longest stretch since 2018 that the S&P 500 has not had a 2% down day. So to me, I say to myself, oh my goodness, that actually incorporates that period of time where we had the SVB collapse and the like here. We are pressing on a period of complacency that I have not seen in a very long time.
Manifesting itself in everything you just talked about. The VIX below 13, obviously that many days in a row of not having a 2% downdraft in the market is, in a word, remarkable, especially when you take into consideration all the events that have happened over that course of time. It's quite remarkable, and it speaks to, again, speaks to flows, and it speaks to optimism and a lot of different things. But in my opinion, it does not speak to improving fundamentals. It speaks to improving optimism, which are entirely different things.
Well, the one thing I'll just push back and just say that there are improving fundamentals, Guy, relative to expectations, right? And
fair.
So when you think about that, and so like when we were coming into this year, I think a lot of folks like who are far more bullish than you and I.
Well, most everybody.
Yes, but we're suggesting that 10%, 11% expected year-over-year earnings growth for 2024 in the S&P 500 was aggressive. And now, after what we saw out of Q4 earnings and Q1 guidance, I think a lot of folks got a little bit more comfortable with that. So that's the one pushback I would just have, you know, on that topic. And then, like, listen, just to kind of look back and hear what we heard, I think that Jensen Huang in San Francisco, the CEO of NVIDIA, in front of 15, 16,000, how many? I mean, think about that. At this event that was treated like, you know, it was the
rock
next
concert.
Coming, yeah, or something like that. I just think we're going to look back and say probably we got a little bit over our skis as far as the near-term enthusiasm in and around this AI trade, because it really is now starting to engulf like all parts of the tech market.
2 Fridays ago, as we're listening to this today on a Friday, that we had that major reversal in NVIDIA where we had from peak to trough, the company lost almost $250 billion of market cap, which is a staggering number when, as we've pointed out a number of times, there are only probably 50 or 60 companies that large in the world in the first place. That engulfing pattern, that peak to trough decline that we saw on that Friday, has not been violated. It's still in place. And although NVIDIA's gone lower, it's gone a little bit higher, it's still basically been sideways since that day. So I will point out yet again that that pattern, which for technicians is extraordinarily important and does not happen all that much, is something that is still in place and something we should still watch.
Yeah, and I guess the story of Apple, which is down over 3% today because the Department of Justice is opening a probe against them. The story of Apple, and you and I have talked about this on Market Call a little bit, is that the stock market, as it broadens out, can go higher without some of these big leaders. And if you're looking within the semi space, and here's a good example, you know, this is only a $100 billion plus market cap company, but Micron, as we speak, is up 16% at a new all-time high after a much better than expected earnings. So you're seeing Broadcom, which last week was down a lot, like 10% or so after a disappointing guide. That's up 8%. So you're starting to see a lot of these other players join the party a little bit, and maybe that helps a stock like Nvidia go sideways and the market continues to move higher. I'm not buying them here. That's not my point. I just think that, again, there's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of pull forward here, but there also seems to be a lot of headwinds that the market seems very complacent about.
In the words of McCartney and Lennon, I don't want to spoil the party, so I'll go. So I don't want to screw this up on you folks.
So we're just going to drop the mic?
No, but I'm going to point something else out, that the fact that the gold market very quietly continues to make all-time highs. Say what you want, but historically, gold's been a bit of a warning sign for risk assets when gold starts a move to the upside. And we're clearly seeing that, regardless of what you want to say, it is happening right before our very eyes, that more and more people are starting to understand that, wait a second, there's something happening here. And it's happening alongside, obviously, Bitcoin, which has effectively been off to the races. But gold is its own animal right now, and it's starting to take the gold miners with it. And I believe it might be telling a cautionary tale for risk assets over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Again, like lots of headwinds that are kind of firming up in our eyes. But again, we would have kind of noted those same headwinds a month ago, 3 months ago, and the like here. The last thing I'll just say is that we mentioned the word complacency. We kind of highlight some kind of risk assets and some instruments that reinforce the level of complacency. It can remain complacent for an awful long time. But if you are really bullish, I mean, one of the best things that I think could happen to your kind of intermediate to longer term view is put a little fear back in investors' minds a little bit. Take some of the froth out of this market, because that's how really meaningful, I think, uptrends continue to happen. You know what I mean? Despite the fact that they don't care that rates are the exact same spot as they were in December 13th when the S&P was below 4,600 and here we are at 5,250.
It's like many things. Pullbacks are a healthy part of a market, especially if you want a strong foundation. You need to have at some point a healthy pullback that, again, sort of gets some of the dead wood out and allows some of the new money to come in and grow. Because when you have these unabated moves to the upside, typically, especially in these individual names, they don't end particularly well.
All right, Guy. Well, you and I are getting a little hard to handle here.
Like
that was a
there.
Good wrap of the week
like
here. And
there.
I'm really excited to listen to the conversation with Danny Moses, Vincent Daniel, and Porter Collins.
Love those three guys. Stick around, because it's going to be a lot of fun, folks. With CME Group's micro-sized futures and options, you can access the same transparency and liquidity of the benchmark contracts with less upfront financial commitment. Diversify your portfolio and manage your exposure with the flexibility of CME Group micro-contracts in crypto, metals, FX, energy, and equity indices. Learn more about what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/micros. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, Salt iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io. Trading options might be new for you, or maybe you've been doing it for a while. Either way, Fidelity is your go-to source for clear and relevant information about trading options. For example, ask Fidelity professionals questions during their live small classes and coaching sessions and learn more with educational videos, articles, and webinars. Plus, with Fidelity's straightforward tools and technology, you'll find it easier than ever to trade options your way. See what's waiting for you at fidelity.com/ options. Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request.
Welcome back to On the Tape for another edition, a March Madness edition of What Are We Doing? A little more regular these days. Had you guys on a couple weeks ago, so great to have you back. Fresh off of global central banks all over the place, NVIDIA's, quote, AI day, ahead of Microsoft's AI day, and just general euphoria in the market, boys. Welcome back to What Are We Doing? And On the Tape.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
Let's go around the world here on global central banks, and then obviously we're going to focus mainly on the U.S. Federal Reserve. Give me your thoughts on BOJ, Swiss National Bank, BOE, kind of themes that you guys are seeing out there and how it's still kind of the dominant thing that's driving all market forces.
Over the past year, a lot of us got a lot of things wrong, but what we did get right is the general direction of inflation assets, the direction of where we thought that the Fed would be headed. And we have to ask ourselves why Powell did what he did yesterday, right? And I think there's a lot of other people in the markets that said, I don't get it. Why did they revise up GDP, revise up inflation, and still say three cuts? And I think you have to go to the why. And the why is the government has been growing debt at 9.5% year over year. We're $34.5 trillion now. And they have a problem of how to fund all this debt. And they obviously want lower rates to fund all this debt. And I think you can see in Bitcoin and gold and other inflation-related assets, they've all gone up pretty substantially recently. And even stocks are a great inflation protector in terms of everything else is being revalued against the dollar. And you know, the only thing about why the dollar stayed strong, I think, is that all other governments are doing the same thing. And so I think you've had Luke Grohman on, and he's talked about some more things. And we've talked about that for a long time. And we feel good about a lot of our ideas and in terms of inflation protected assets.
Vinny, before I go to you here, let me just reset the table here. So Bank of Japan ended their negative interest rate policy, but then obviously was very dovish on the back end of that. The Porter's point is why the dollar stands up. Swiss National Bank cut for the first time in their cycle today, 25 basis points, right? BOE's holding kind of firm. But Porter's alluding to this fiscal dominance that Luke Grohman has talked about, which basically inflates all assets.
It's funny. I remember listening to Luke, and I listened to him a lot, but you guys had him on the tape about a month ago, and really take his words to what they mean. I'll try to synthesize it. In an era of fiscal dominance, it's going to dominate monetary policy. It has no choice. And when you think about it that way, when you say, we have too much debt, we have to fund that debt. And as a result of that, but we have to fund that debt, more importantly, at a cheap coupon. And when you think about it that way, when you take that into account, almost everything you see the Fed and Janet Yellen do makes a heck of a lot of sense. In that, I don't like it, I hate it, but when I think about it through that lens, it makes a lot of sense. So let's say what he was talking about yesterday. It wasn't just good enough to indicate that cuts were coming. He actually had to increase the percentage chance that QT will end sooner rather than later. There was no reason for him to truly do that, other than the fact that when you actually start to think that you're going to have the Fed competing against Janet Yellen issuing coupon paper, doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense for the Fed to be exercising QT in an accelerated fashion. You need to reduce it. So the sad part is, and I think, Danny, you got to this, is the Fed is in control, clearly. Anyone who says that the Fed has lost control, I would suggest to them to look at what happened to markets yesterday. I think that's exactly what they wanted and needed. It's our job to say, okay, here's the hand that we're dealt. What do you want to buy as a result of what they are trying to do? And we just keep coming back to precious metals, gold and silver, and almost everything tangible. That also includes, to a certain extent, Bitcoin. And that's where we just keep leading our assets. Our incremental buys are in those sectors and those themes.
There was a Richard Kimball fugitive moment there yesterday that we talked about. You changed the sample so you could have your RUD90 Pervasic. For Powell to say that you can ignore the strong labor market, to me, to take it one step further, the strong labor market is great. It's great for the economy, but it indicates potentially continued pressure on wages and wage inflation. That was the one thing that didn't resonate with me. Listen, it is what it is. You've said it best. The Fed is in control. They're controlling basically the money flows. They are controlling asset allocation. The bond market held steady for the day yesterday. That could change. But Porter, you mentioned that kind of we talked about federal debt levels, and at some point they will matter. I don't care. Maybe it's not today, tomorrow. Maybe it's not even the next 6 months. It will matter. And if we get to a point in the next kind of 3 to 4 months here where inflation does rear its head again, and then the thought turns to the moment of, okay, Benny's point, how are you going to fund all this debt you have to issue? What does that look like? And what happens in that moment?
I've argued for a long time that it is mattering, and you are seeing the outcropping of this higher debt. This is what's happening. And they're taking their R star higher than, I think, quietly in there. They're saying, well, it wasn't 2%. Maybe it's a little bit higher than 2% that we're going to level out. And they keep on referring to over time, get down to 2%. So they're sort of ignoring the inflation part of it for now. And you know, the question I really have to ask you guys is, okay, what's going to derail the Fed? What's really going to stop this party, which is seems like an inflate all asset party? And I think you guys know the answer to that, but the answer is higher rates. And if you go back to the U.S. 10-year and you look at the chart and you look at the top of yields, it occurred exactly to the same day that the S&P bottomed, right? The rates went to 10-year went to 5%. And I think that's when Janet Yellen said, she switched from 80% coupon to 80% bills. And lo and behold, the 10-year goes from 5% to 370. Right over the preceding 2 months, and the S&P hasn't looked back yet. So I would say that the check on this market will be higher rates. And the funny part about the dot plots yesterday, they took the dot plots on the longer and the out years higher. I think yesterday everyone just looked at the giant dove festival and rates went down and, euphoria.
Well, they did raise GDP, but they also raised PCE, and there really was no change to the rate cuts to the end of 2025. I think that's correct. But Vinny, kind of your thoughts on that and rates moving higher. We've seen the impact, and Porter's really talking about the longer end, obviously. 10-year yields is really what we're talking about. And we've seen kind of these knee-jerk reactions, both on buying and selling, in terms of companies that are more exposed than others. We've seen sectors that have benefited from this, et cetera.
In terms of the 10-year, which I always say, if you had to put me on a desert island and tell me where markets are, what's the one metric I would take with me? It would be the 10-year treasury to determine where things are going. On the 10-year, I joke around prior to the Fed, and we're forgetting a very important point, and I'll get to that in a second. We used to sing on the desk, Natalie Imbruglia, Torn, right? Yeah. I'm quite torn on the 10-year treasury. I can make the case both sides. Analyst Vinny suggests that the yield on the 10-year treasury should go up based upon what he did rather than go down, simply because you have a further loosening of financial conditions, a further potential increase of inflationary expectations. So as a result, the 10-year, the long bond, the yield should go up, not down. But of course, market Vinny says that's not what Powell wants. That's not what Yellen wants. So as a result, I'm very torn about it. Let's not forget that the word Fed and independence should be thrown in the trash can or in the toilet and just put to bed, right? Powell has a boss. He has bosses. President Biden is his boss. Congress is his boss. I think he showed his hand in 2018 when President Trump desperately wanted him to cut rates. And I think it was the day before Christmas Eve where he showed the intent to cut rates. This is an election year. And by God, Biden needs everything to work correctly in order to give him a better chance of getting reelected. I know it's hard to prove, it'll be impossible to prove, but again, coming back, when you start thinking about fiscal dominance and you start thinking about the election, all of a sudden, everything he's doing makes significantly more sense than the logic, the analyst Vinny hat that says, how in the world did he not even recognize, like you said, Danny, even recognize the increase in inflation and loosening of financial conditions over the past 2-3 months. There are bigger objectives.
Vinny, if this inflates everything, and you talked before about gasoline and eggs and chicken and so forth, that affects the majority of people because most people are not market participants, right? The majority of voters out there may still feel the pinch as a result of something like that. So how do you reconcile that logic?
To me, the only inflation that Biden seems to truly care about, and you nailed it, Danny, is the price at the pump and the price of eggs and the price of chicken, you know, all that stuff that everything on Wall Street they exclude. That's what's important to them. And as a result, if we start to see that continue to creep up, I think food prices, I haven't looked, I have to be honest, but food prices have been subdued. But if the price at the pump starts to increase, you're going to start to see Biden chirp, and he's going to say to Powell, get it down. And Powell's going to say, you realize that if I get it down, I have to raise rates again and the markets are going to go down. So the way I think about it is we get closer and closer to more plates spinning and more they have to keep them spinning. But I have to give the Fed credit just from an outsider. It's amazing they keep getting themselves out of a corner. And you have to respect that as a market participant investing in asset classes. You have to respect their ability to get themselves out of the corner, or the market's interpretation of them being able to get themselves out of the corner, which is what they need.
I give the Fed a lot of credit. They've been dealt a horrible hand. Given what Congress and government have dealt them, a lot of people talk about trying to inflate the debt away. But the problem is that, again, debt is growing at 9.5%. Nominal GDP is at 6. We're not inflating away anything. Like, the debt's getting bigger. And, you know, the fiscal irresponsibility is just, is unbelievable what's going on. And that's where I'm fucking angry, right? Talk about the anger of what we're talking about. Like, the Fed's trying to do gymnastics in the background to fix all the other stuff that's going on.
What we do with our portfolio and our anger are really two separate and distinct things. The other thing I would say is, it was several months ago, I'm trying to get Guy to change his view on two different things. You know, the handsome Guy Adami. One is his hatred of the Mets and the Jets just is ill-founded. I don't know why you hate the teams that have sucked for so long and you're a Yankees and a Giants fan. And the other thing is to turn his vitriol away from the Fed. I'm not exonerating the Fed, a card-carrying hater. But Porter's right. What goes on in D.C., the fiscal, is so embarrassing. And there doesn't seem to be any hint of recognition of what they're doing. And all the Fed does is aid and abet the stupidity.
It's embarrassing what Warren and Bernie Sanders did and begging them to lower rates. Like, they gave up the Fed independence a long time ago. The fact that Janet Yellen, the ex-Fed president, is running the secretary. The whole thing's a freaking joke at this point. Like, it's just, it really is.
Well, so, Porter, to your point, 9.5% growth in debt, that doesn't even include, or separate from that, is the level of interest that's being paid and replaced as debt comes due and you issue new debt. They need, back to his comment, which is hypocritical, Powell's comment about ignoring job growth, they need GDP growth, to your point, to offset that, or to at least, and they can't even get close to that level, but that's why they'd be willing to do that, is my guess. If a strong labor market, then that should be a strong economy, et cetera. But again, I think it's futile. I don't think it really does anything in the scheme of things to really offset that.
The gold bugs and I'll give some credit to them, the Bitcoin guys later, this is the stuff that they've been talking about for years.
Let's dive into, if you can't beat it, join it. And what do you do? And we've all been talking about gold for a while, and it's finally, it's working. It's been working, but now it's really feel like it's starting to accelerate.
Our portfolio is more dominated by gold than Bitcoin, but I view them as check marks to fiscal and monetary policy. And that they're supposed to be anchors. And because you can't print gold and you can't print Bitcoin, and historically gold has been the monetary base of the world that has been used mainly because man or woman can't be trusted with fiat currency. So when you think of it that way and you say, okay, how are governments doing in terms of fiscal balances, soundness of fiscal monetary printing money? And the answer is it's a D or F grade. I'll give Powell a slightly better grade than that, or did, but now he's succumbing to what is needed to be done in order for fiat to continue to exist in an era of fiscal dominance. So it just comes back to us to say, this is what we should be owning, because they're going to continue to debase you. They don't have a choice. They're going to continue to debase your currency. And I've learned it the hard way that owning cash or holding on to cash is really difficult because you're losing the power of your asset every day because they're going to debase the value of the dollar.
To be fair to a lot of the people who own the S&P, the S&P has been a much better hedge. These blue chip tech companies are cash flowing machines, right? And they've shown unbelievable operating leverage to the environment. Look at NVIDIA. Like, the estimates were supposed to be $5, and I don't even know what they are, but they're in the 20s, I think it is. They've shown unbelievable operating leverage to this market, and they've been much better inflation hedges. And historically, the three of us have been people who've shorted a lot of stocks. we are short stocks, but not a lot. It's a hard environment to short stocks, and you really have to be right on the fundamentals and the flows and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, what I think we've done a better job is just not fighting the market recently. And so, again, I think that the only thing that you have to watch out for is if the bond vigilantes win here and the long-term rates become unhinged and you see a move back towards 5%. I see that's the biggest risk to this market.
Listen, the bulls are clearly in control of the market still. Money flows, you're right, are finding kind of the growthy names. We've never been saying we're bad growth investors, never been pure growth investors, more growth at a reasonable price type of investors. And when you see a name like Micron, again, revalue itself overnight, right? We know how cyclical memory chips can be, but it doesn't look that expensive on current numbers. And when you beat like that, if you're a money manager, you have to own it or you're the chump. So you can see how why these stocks would continuously revalue themselves. My question becomes, again, we're dealing in a sector in semiconductors, which are cyclical by nature or in a secular trade. You just can't fight that, to your point. And you have IPOs happening like Astera Labs yesterday, which does great. Great for the IPO market, great for capital markets, and lends itself to wanting to own, again, some of these banks where the comps are starting to get easier year over year. There was no issuance last year. Very few IPOs. There was some M&A, but not a lot. So that activity just feeds on itself. And so, again, you can ignore it if you want to, but to me, it's just part of the thematic investments which have been going on, which again, you got to prove the bulls wrong. So I'm not saying to short any of these names. What I'm saying is you have to respect it. I just don't know, to your point, what it will take to make that quote money flows end. Is it as simple as rates moving higher and 10-year yields moving higher? That I don't know.
We kept on talking about last one, macro versus micro. And I think the difference between this market and between the speculative boom of 21, I think the market here is being a lot more discerning of what's going on. These crappy non-cash flow companies, they have short spikes, but they're not going up, right? Look at the Mag 7. The stocks that are going up are the ones with the earnings estimates are going up the most, right? NVIDIA has been ripping it. Amazon's been crushing numbers. Apple has had flat earnings for 2-3 years now, right? They're finally realizing that Tesla is not a hype machine. It's a car company.
Tesla, minute 23, Tesla. Sorry, took 23 minutes. That's the longest ever. Sorry.
That's all right.
It's evident.
We waited it out.
Covered some recently, rang the bell. I'm sure we'll reshort it, but it's worked, right? In this market, you don't get paid for pressing shorts all the way down. So, but whatever.
But you're still short some, just to be clear.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Yes.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify that.
The beauty of Tesla, at least from an analyst perspective, is that the numbers are coming down, right? And they keep coming down. And so the multiple keeps increasing. And thank God there are alternatives to large money managers that can buy things, as Porter said, such as NVIDIA versus Tesla. And I think that's the reason why the short is working. It's working because of fundamentals, and that feels really good. Now, will there be squeezes off of technical bounces? You bet your ass. We know that. And that's the reason why we covered a portion of it. But we still have a pretty sizable position in Tesla.
In this market, it's actually been pretty good for guys who like to pick stocks, right? You've had some good ones. Look at ExxonMobil. You were pounding the table on the lows, and it's been a great stock. Walmart's been great. A lot of these stocks have been pretty good. If you like fundamentals, like to pick stocks, they've been acting rationally. This is not an irrational market.
They're just not as sexy. So shifting again, I got to bring up the sector again. Banks are bifurcated again, I think, with the regionals and the large cap. They're not cheap. The large banks are not cheap. It feels like there's regulatory relief on the horizon for these banks. And if things go wrong, the first sector to get relief, obviously, is the banks. How are you guys viewing the banks at this point? And within that, kind of the CRE issue, which is still front and center, but doesn't seem to really get much of headlines anymore.
The NYCB has real problems, right? The loan portfolio isn't great. The question is, how dire is it, right? And you bring out old memories of stress testing losses, right? And you go through how bad can losses be. What I think happened to NYB is that 3 or 4 quarters ago, they hadn't taken a loss in 25 or 30 years of their multifamily portfolio. And then all of a sudden in 2 quarters, you start to see delinquency spikes, charge-off spike, and the regulators come in there and forcing them on higher reserves and then forcing them to build capital. And so I think that abrupt change freaked people out. Again, I think the regulators created a mess by not doing anything for a long time, coming in and creating a lot of noise. The other point I would say is that this CRE issue is not going away. It's going to be a slow burn for, I think, a lot of quarters until the Fed aggressively cuts rates a couple hundred basis points and the long end comes down. But I think Powell had it right. He said it will be manageable. I think these banks do have reserves, right? They have a 1.5% or 2% reserve on their loan portfolio for a reason. And they do have the earnings power to take the charge-offs. And obviously the well-run banks do.
Also think, Powell knows the issues associated with commercial real estate. And as a result, it only helps for him to try and lower rates would alleviate some of the pains associated with commercial real estate. So yet another reason that he can't really state as to why his tilt is more to the dovish camp than the hawkish camp. What intrigues us is that year to date, the XLF versus the KRE, the disparity is 16% year to date, 16% outperformance by the XLF versus the KRE. And the reason that is the case is because the XLF now is littered with a bunch of non-banks and JP Morgan, where the KRE is a pure regional banks. We've been sifting around in the KRE, trying to find regional banks that are stupidly cheap, been thrown out. And as a result, we feel tremendous margin of safety to buy it, particularly that we might have some form of a tailwind coming from Powell, or at least Powell's on our side to express that position. We ran into Truist, TFC. And when we do this, keep in mind, Danny, you know as well we do, some of the things that we own, we can't necessarily say we love from a business perspective or a bank perspective, but they just get too cheap. And as a result, Truist got extremely cheap. They recently sold their insurance brokerage business for, I think, 14 to 15 times EBITDA, and now are flush with capital and incredibly cheap. So we found a reason to buy that stock. And we find ourselves being long more regional banks than we've had in recently.
We don't love them, but they get to a place where they're cheap enough. And you have our friends who are value guys banging the table at these things. Look at they're cheap. And all the macro guys saying they're shorts. Look at the commercial real estate. These things suck. And the truth's somewhere in the middle.
When there's a crisis in a certain regional bank and people's initial response is, I'm shorting the KRE. I'm buying puts on the KRE. You throw the baby out with the bathwater. Some people think we short everything. No, you take the opportunity for the overreaction on the sell-off and then you can buy names. I think that's a smart way to do it. So diving into kind of the rest of your portfolio here, changes that you've made in the last few months, thoughts, obviously you just mentioned a new name, and for people out there who have never heard of Truist, that was the SunTrust BB&T merger, if I'm not mistaken.
It was not our favorite name in the portfolio.
No, I'm not saying it's your favorite name, but listen, people want, when you buy a regional bank, you're going to wake people up because that means that you guys have scrutinized this thing enough. So going through the portfolio, I know you got some energy names, some gold miners.
As much as we absolutely hate the gold miners, and you know, I think it's been a very frustrating sector for anyone who's been involved, is because you know the inflation aspects of labor and a lot of these gold mines are in jurisdictions like Mexico or odd places around the world where the inflation is much higher. The cost pressures have been tight and the gold prices hasn't gone up that much until recently. And so they've been very bad stocks. And, you know, for a trade, we've been in the gold miners more recently as gold at $2,200. It makes a big difference between 1900 and 22. And so there's a lot of operating leverage as price goes up. And so we've found ourselves in the gold miners for the first time in a while for a trade. So we like that. Obviously, the biggest one we pounded the table on was BGC, and it's worked. You know, one of the reasons it's worked recently is that lo and behold, it got it added to an index. Amazing what happens when you find these orphans, these stocks that eventually the passive funds come and find them. And if you can find names like that, I think it really works. Petrobras has been a frustrating one for us this year, but the stock is off the generational lows when it got to bound to 1.5 times EBITDA where we bought the stock. It's now 2 and change, still sporting a 14-15% dividend, not as great as it was, you know, a year ago. But I still think Brent crude is $85, $90. And they're going to produce a lot of cash flows at these levels. And I think that, you know, a lot of these energy companies with the oil level here are going to produce a lot of cash flows. We're still in uranium. You saw the uranium price come down from 100 to the mid 80s. And I think you've seen the utilities come in and say, that's a level that I want to go ahead and buy uranium. Those are some of the names we like. We've been doing more of this stuff, but our original thought process post the SPAC boom and bust was, hey, there's got to be a graveyard here of stocks that we can find. And so we have a friend of ours we invested in that does SPACs, but he does it more for a yield thing, buying stocks below 10 and earning a yield on that. But I think that if you are a fundamental analyst and you want to do some due diligence on some of these stocks, there are some really weird names in there, that the SPACs that have resurrected from the dead, and they paid too much for them. They had a lot of bad incentives in terms of stock options and stuff like that, granted to the people who did these things. But I think if you sift through some of these SPACs, it is interesting. I was looking at one the other day that we don't own yet, Black Rifle Coffee, something like 10, 12 times next year's earnings for a coffee company. They're building out stores just like Dutch Bros is, but Dutch Bros is a bazillion times earnings. And so people who like to do some of this stuff, sift through some of the SPACs, there will be some stuff they come out of the graveyard.
Was Genius Sports a SPAC?
Yes, so was DraftKings.
So there's a great example of a SPAC where the belief is that, yes, it got thrown out, and now it's at an incredibly palatable price with what I would argue is one of the better moats in the gaming business. You would know better than I would. The only thing I would add to Porter, he referenced it. One of the things that we have owned, feels like forever, that has had a recent drawdown has been uranium. And the underlying price of uranium, the spot price, has gone from 106, it's now, I believe, 88.50, and it got down as low as 82. As a result, the stock's sold off accordingly. We find ourselves getting more compelled to add to our position at these levels because the supply-demand dynamics of the underlying business still remain, for the next 3, 5, 10 years, remain extremely favorable. And in a space like uranium, you're going to have some major drawdowns. It just is what it is. You're going to have to deal with the volatility if you're going to want to play there. But I just see the underlying growth dynamics, one of the cleanest energy sources that is gaining traction globally, is a place where you probably want to come in and play again.
I'm going to come full circle here a little bit. Another SPAC, I believe, was Glasshouse, and that's part of the cannabis trade. And as cannabis has had a rough couple of years, you know, we've had the opportunity to do some due diligence, and we've stumbled across Glasshouse, which is a California grower, and it basically breaks even, makes a little bit of money. And if you do get descheduling, we think it's a real big winner. Again, out of the rubble of SPACs, there are some names which are interesting, and they're not in indices yet. Glasshouse doesn't even trade on the NYSE yet. So if you do get a descheduling happen, you will see all these companies list on the New York Stock Exchange. You will see them find indices, and there will be a big trade. You probably don't have to buy them right now, but when this rescheduling comes out, you will see a massive trade here. And I think it's one that's buyable on dips.
Yeah, I totally agree. And Vinny, we'll never let you leave ever one of these things without talking about credit. Tax refund season is basically here. And what are you seeing on the credit landscape for consumers?
The other day, a friend of mine put out a great chart. It's a pet peeve of mine. When people put out charts on Twitter and they only show the last 2-3 years and call it like all-time highs or all-time lows, and all you're showing me is a chart that goes back to 2017, 18, or 19. It's just poor context. So a friend of mine, Randy Woodward, put out a chart of Capital One's default rates going back to, I think, 2005, 2006. And what it showed was what we're seeing right now, which is defaults are increasing. It's undeniable, as have delinquencies. But relative to prior periods in history, particularly the GFC, we're nowhere near the peaks or the highs. I think right now we are in probably the end of a credit normalization cycle. And what I mean by that is we probably have seen the worst of the increase of defaults associated with the card business. It will get worse if unemployment gets worse now going forward. However, this is my word of caution, is I do not believe we're going to see a material improvement in defaults over the next 2-3 years, similar to what we experienced over the last 14 years, mainly because right now at this point in time, mortgage refinance volume, which is a big component seeing an improvement in defaults, is not there. So I actually think what we're seeing now is what we're going to get going forward, which is a more normalized cycle. I don't know how the stocks act to that once they realize that the charge-offs are not going down 200 basis points from these levels. But that said, I'm not in the camp that we're going off a cliff unless we get unemployment to go the wrong way.
So many of these companies are appropriately reserved, but don't expect reserve releases to enhance earnings necessarily going forward, is probably a better way
Correct.
To put it. And then within that, we've seen buy now, pay later, just as an area that we've all focused on. And that's the really lower end and or the end of the credit card spectrum, right? So what are you seeing there? Because I know that we've seen data come out in these pools of loans that are out there that don't look as good as the stuff you're talking about.
I think about differing strategies within the group. right? So for right now, Upstart has been retrenching. They've reduced their origination volume. And so right now, their earnings, or lack of earnings — none of these companies really make earnings — but their lack of earnings continues to go down. They're showing themselves as a pure mortgage bank or consumer bank. I think they're making the right decision, but it doesn't mean you should necessarily own the stock, because I think the stock is overvalued. Affirm's doing the exact opposite, right? They're truly in the buy now, pay later space, along with PayPal and the like. They're gunning it. And so as a result, their growth, their revenues, and everything else is going to look pristine over the next few quarters. However, I think that's going to probably be a major problem, say 6 months from now, 9 months from now. So that's the way my head is thinking about how I position myself in these names. And then lastly, on SoFi, I think they did a much needed capital raise. And as a result, they are doing what they're doing, which is trying to grow their member base.
Hopefully we're doing this more regularly. I think the markets will need that to hear from you guys, because I think we're going to enter here a pretty volatile period. So it's amazing how volatility to me is never measured when the markets are going up like this, as opposed to going down. But I consider this market up or down as volatile and opportunistic. So thank you guys for coming back on, and look forward to having you guys on again.
I appreciate it.
Thanks again to our presenting sponsors, CME Group, iConnections, and FactSet.
If you like what you heard, make sure you hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show, and we also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com.
Derivatives are not suitable for all investors and involve the risk of losing more than the amount originally deposited and any profit you might have made. This communication is not a recommendation or offer to buy, sell, or retain any specific investment or service.